I get the honor to introduce our speaker. I got to meet her at an event up in Buford and loved her story and that kind of stuff. So when they told me she was a speaker again, it's like, yay, we're in for a nice treat. And she's got a wonderful story and uplifting. And, of course, she is wearing my favorite color, purple, which she explained to me today that was a sobriety color. So it's like, okay, great. Anyway, she has a wonderful message. It's a beautiful example of this program. So come on up, Meredith.
My name is Meredith, and I'm an alcoholic. And just a couple of housekeeping things. I am beyond honored and a little baffled by getting the invitation to speak at this meeting. My sobriety rests on the shoulders of the people that were before me. As an alcoholic, I did a lot of dishonor to my family and my legacy. I appreciate the 12 steps and good sponsorship and fellowship that I could, in God's way, turn that around. I am a ham, so that's good. So it was really special to be, you know, the honored speaker this year. They, you know, filled me with food last night and said, and get back here early for more of that. And so that was a compelling. You know, and homage to the old-timers, a man that sponsored me for an interim. I had a woman that sponsored me when I first came in, and then a man named Rusty Jones. And I love the man, and he's getting well in the hospital today. So, and I sent him a text saying, I know you'd want to be here more than anything in spite of, you know, no matter who the speaker, but I'll be sure to send you a link. You know. And the gentleman who picked up the 5 days, if I didn't have a 12-step program, I would have drank over the Yankees this year, too. We'd have had to fight over that book signed by Helen Soper. Okay. My sponsor reminded me, okay, housekeeping, Meredith alcoholic. My AA birthday is May 30th, 1998. That makes me a babe in this room of old-timers of 25 years, by the grace of God. And I came into AA a few years before that because alcohol seemed problematic. And I had a friend who was court-ordered in, and I thought, well, I'll be her sobriety buddy. And I went to meetings in the dark at the 8111 Club and ran the gauntlet past all the friendly welcomers to the back of the room and shared on the topic. Sometimes it was sex, sometimes it was, you know, I hate people. You know, it was a pretty wild, random meeting. But at that time, I was really just coming to take notes and find out how I didn't qualify to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, even though as a child, I witnessed alcoholic behavior in my home. It also looked like a lot of fun. But anyway, I didn't stay the first time. Meetings didn't keep me sober, and I still had more research to do, and what brought me back was my own fear of my own self. Fear and desperation drove me back in. My home group meets there to this day. It's a book study. It meets on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. in the little room, Sunday nights at 7 in the big room. It's a hybrid meeting on Sunday nights, and I'll be there tonight because that's my commitment. And commitments, you know, I had a good sponsor, but just to back up a little bit. So growing up in my house, it was like a vision out of Mad Men. My father was an executive in New York City. There were 5 kids in the house, and we always had to be sent to the children's area when the party started, and I really hated that. I liked the cigarette smoke and the laughing and the whoa, and the tinkling of the glasses, and I was the one that ran around and smelled those glasses and ate the cherries and loved it. And when Mommy and Daddy kissed me goodnight and smelled like booze, I loved that more. I loved alcohol before I really even drank it. And I liked the milieu, you know, what was going on around alcohol, okay? So I didn't have my first drink, really, till I was 10. Restless and irritable long enough, you know. I had a certain nervous disposition, you know, in a big family, not sure if there's enough to go around, am I getting enough attention, you know, the important things. And so on Thanksgiving, Grandma said, oh, let the kids have a little champagne. How could that hurt? And beautiful glasses. Isn't it funny how we love pretty bottles and glasses? Am I the only one? Like maple syrup that comes in. Anyway. So champagne, little things of champagne for all of us. And my brother Matthew had a sip and didn't like it. And my brother Jeffrey didn't like it. And I love mine. Thank you. Thank my sister. So I had about 4 ounces of champagne, and I loved what it did for me. Made me all warm inside and all tingly, and suddenly I didn't mind playing piano for Aunt Ginger. Gosh, I hated taking piano. And it was just really fun. And then I had a nap, you know, and suddenly, and woke up with a really bad headache. But I also thought, man, I can't wait until Christmas, because we drink champagne at Christmas too. And little did I know it, that was the seed of the obsession. Right? The obsession. I suffer from an allergy of the body and obsession of the mind. And the first thing that I recognize is the allergy. I drink it and I love what it does for me. And then I think about how much I love what it did for me. But I'm only 10. But I can tell you, at Christmas, I drank a few more of those little things of champagne. And when Thanksgiving rolled around, as it began to approach, I began to think, how can I ask for a bigger glass without that looking too weird? Because I was, after all, only 11. But I'm already starting to jones for it, you know what I mean? So I was raised in the suburbs of New York. My father decided we used to mountain climb. You know, our vacations were more like outward bound experiences, dehydrated food and sleeping on wooden lean-to floors, and hiking all day in the rain. But I didn't want to appear like I was a wuss, you know. I was raised pre-Phil Donahue era, pre-Oprah, pre-how you feeling, you know. You don't feel good? Go mow the lawn. Okay? So, you know, we just didn't talk about all that going on, you know. And my father was sort of, you know, he was the head of the house. My mom was a virgin when she got married. She believed in God first and husband second. And they both gave it a shaft, by the way, which you'll hear. So by the time we moved to the Adirondacks, you know, he wanted to get us out of the city so we'd have room to grow. But there was only, you know, 1,000 households there, and there was nothing to do except drink and ride the back roads, which was fine for me. Yeah, I was fine with that. But I had a queer idea of a good time, right? Most of my friends were riding their Stingray bicycles and jumping in the rich guy's pool, and I'm, you know, hitting the apple, you know, out Boone's Farm with the 18-year-old boys and girls, you know? And I was a good student. I was the oldest daughter. I like to do well. I like to win the respect and love of others. And if I could do that by getting good grades, by golly, I'm going to get good grades. And I found that the better behaved you were outwardly, the less you were suspected of being in that group that did that other thing over there, stealing the pumpkins at the, you know, and throwing them on the town hill or whatever. So I was able to, I started leading the double life. 13, 14, and before I knew it, I was gaining a reputation that I ignored. Yeah, I'm going to pretend I didn't hear that. It seemed, in Bill's story, he talks about out of the mix of alcohol and speculation, I began to forge a weapon that would turn into flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. My alloy was alcohol and socialization, and particularly men. And so they put those two together, and you can tell the progression of my alcoholism by my nicknames. My mom called me Sparkle Plenty and her precious girl, and then I was mouthy, and then I was show off and bossy, and then easy, and they didn't mean easy going, which I'm clearly not. So I'm going through high school, and I'm leading a double life. I'm doing well in school. And I tell myself, I'm really doing fine. I mean, I'm captain of the cheerleading squad. I'm the only one that can really organize anything. That's the only reason. I couldn't even do a flip. I was the president of the student council. I ran unopposed. Apathy. So much apathy. Nobody cared. I was queen of the prom because I was dating the cutest boy in the class. And there were only 7 boys, okay? My class, in the Adirondack Mountains, 16 women, 7 boys. And it didn't matter if he beat me black and blue, I was hanging on to him like it was my life depended on it. because I felt I deserved the way I was treated for the things I'd done. And he reminded me of that, my past and all that. So I took beatings, and I accepted it as part of a relationship, and so I understand that cycle. I understand what people say, why don't they get out of it? And luckily I graduated, and I was valedictorian, but not because I was the smartest. Oh no, the smartest guy graduated a year earlier. So everything, all the honor I ever got was by default. I went to college to study to be a nurse, not knowing that was a calling and not just a job you get. And I'm not a nurse. I'm an actress, okay? Playing a nurse. For the first few years of college. And then I thought, I'm going to pursue. What I said was, I can't study. I can't do an assessment that counts. Do they bite their nails? What's their skin look like? You know, what's their weight? Don't even start there. So, you know, so I decided I needed to feel, I knew from a very young age I wanted souls to be fed. So I thought, I'll be an actress. I'll make them laugh. I'll make them cry. I'll be famous in a small Baptist college for women. I went there to try to break the habit I was forming socially, but I discovered townies and foosball. So no matter where I went, there I was. And every 4 years or so, I would rouse myself and move on and start over. And I kept crashing in the same car. So my mom became alcoholic after my father left, and I watched her drink warm beer, cry looking in the mirror why she was abandoned, stop showing up for things she said she would, weak as far as I'm concerned, weak and pathetic. And I was not going to be like that. And when my father left, I decided I didn't need men, I didn't need God. And I was going to take care of things myself. And I was always self-supporting in a very illustrious career of food service. It's a great default career for us alcoholics if you don't paint. So I was a waitress, made a lot of money. I even worked my way through college waiting tables. And then I moved to Lake Placid. I got a job on the Olympic Committee just because I was in the right place at the right time. I was on the ceremonies and awards department, which was all the guns and, you know, whistles and the laser show and the fireworks and all the best drugs you can get your hands on. Now, I'm an alcoholic, but I found that certain drugs helped me manage my alcoholism. And so I wasn't about to say, oh, no, I don't think I'll take that. You know, so, but alcohol was always on the table. And I was able to let everything go except that. So ad nauseum, you know. Okay, so the nicknames continue. Now I've earned the nickname as a bartender because I worked my way down from the nicest club in Lake Placid after the Olympics to the local dive bar, where I made a lot of money because all the local bartenders went there too. But I earned the nickname of Nightmare. So you can kind of see. They say, Nightmare! You know, and then that stuck. And it's funny because when I went back there 2.5 years sober, I heard people say, Nightmare's in town! You gotta, Nightmare's in town! But they were smiling, so that was good. But Nightmare stuck with me, you know, and I remember thinking there was a girl who was a bartender, and she had a real gravelly voice, and her name was Stick. And she was about 5 years older than me, and I got a moment of clarity, you know, that's what my life's going to look like. You know, bartenders are good old Joe, and they're distinguished, and then they're Stick and Gladys with the gravelly voices and the cigarettes hanging out of their mouths. And so I thought, I really probably ought to make a break for it. And at moments, I would think to myself, I'm pretty sure this isn't what God had in mind for me, you know, being a nightmare that bartended. My brother was a musician. He was 1 year younger than me. He used to write songs. He's written 3 about me. And the first one was about a song about a waitress. And one of the lines is, she only could see the mountains from the valley below. And that was accurate. And he says, when are you going to, what are you waiting for? What are you waiting for? And I was terrified to make a move. I was in a small town and I could manage. And what am I going to do in a world of people? But I made a break for it in 1990. I moved to Georgia because my sister lived in Jasper. And she and her husband have a logical idea of what life is all about. They have a good family and they have a faith that works. And I used to go up there on Sundays and have drink iced tea and play games with the kids and do all these normal, wonderful things and wish, why couldn't I have a life like this? And then I drive back down to Dunwoody, and as I'm driving back down, my mind is slipping to the bar, because I can't really live like that. That's not my life. And I can only fake it for so long. And I'm driven by this obsession to drink. And when I drink, I don't have a control of the amount I take. And I hated where I was ending up, but I could not break the cycle. And so the last 6 or 7 years of my drinking were really awful. And my world got really small. But I kept getting promoted in that restaurant business. You know, now I'm director of training. And my job is to, you know, solicit, you know, identify talent and hire them in and train them as managers. Because it used to be when I was a GM at Joey D's at the Perimeter, the boss would say, send the trainee to Meredith. She'll make or break them. And I held some high standards, which if anybody, well, Molly, I sponsored her. She was non-compliant. No, I'm kidding. I set standards, you know, that my sponsor set for me. But anyway, my cousin, she drank like me in Lake Placid, and we were nuts. And she sent me a pamphlet when I was, after about 8 years of living here. And it was a letter to a woman alcoholic. And I was sitting in my underground apartment because I was living in the dark. Okay. I considered suicide, but jumping out the window would have been like an up and out kind of thing. And then the shins, you know, so. There was a stone wall with my name on it in Lake Placid that I just couldn't quite accelerate enough into that wall. And, you know, alcoholism, they say, untreated, leads us into the gates of insanity or death. And for me to think the best answer is killing myself is pretty insane. Right? So my cousin sends me a pamphlet. You know, I'm not trying to tell you what to do, but I know you live and drink like me, and I have a year sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was just crying my eyes out after reading the first page of the pamphlet, The Literature of Alcoholics Anonymous. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where the message is, this is the AA seed. You know, so I came into AA, stayed a while, went back out, made myself nuts, came back in May of 1998. I had met a girl the first time around who sponsored me. And I called her and I said, what are you doing tonight? And she said, nothing. I said, I'm going to go to 8111 and surrender. And I'd never used that word before. And she said, thank God you're back. I'll meet you there. And I remember she handed me her, it was her 2 year anniversary. She handed me her, sorry, I wanted to see if I set the timer. I probably didn't, which is a mistake. Let's just do this. Just back it off a little bit. Okay. So, she met me there, and she gave me her 2 year candle and said, give this to me when you have a year. And I was sobbing. I thought, I want nothing more than to be able to do that. And so I was willing, as only the dying could be. So I came to AA meetings and sat on my hands. And I was thinking about not drinking. Yeah, not drinking one day at a time. I'm a winner, so I'm not drinking one day at a time. And I was so uncomfortable with my own skin. All the fears and insecurities that made me drink are now raging. And I was listening to certain people. I noticed the people in that meeting, they were none of the people that were there before, a year before. None of them. And one person said, you know, they didn't all move. So I started to get an idea of the transitory nature of this thing, you know, if we don't stay. And I was under the impression that meetings were the core of this thing. I don't know where I got that impression, but I was hearing the 12 steps and hearing that everything, 12 things. But I really thought that was the option for the really, you know, the ones that didn't have jobs or houses or teeth or whatever, right? And, yeah, I was fine, you know. But the second time I came in, my mind is what scared me back into here because I was thinking about killing myself, and that was progression. You know, I was smart enough to know there's something really wrong here, and if I can just fix the alcohol thing, maybe I can get better. I didn't know that the obsession of the mind was part of that. So when I finally asked this woman to be my sponsor, I said, will you be my temporary sponsor? And she said, do you want temporary sobriety? I'm like, I don't know. And she went to, since I read the book, yeah, in the sport of the second edition, who reads those, right? Let's see, right here. It says right here, strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, is vital to permanent recovery. I'm like, permanent? You can say permanent, eh? Didn't know that. How about we just gut it out one day at a time, man, so they don't get struck drunk? Right? So I was like, wow, okay. And she goes, so have you ever, so what's your deal? I said, well, I had about 90 days and I chose to drink again. She goes, what do you mean you chose to drink again? Did you have a sponsor? No. Did you work the steps? No. Spiritual awakening? No. Well, what makes you think you had a choice? I said, well, that's what they say here. And she gets the italics on page 20. Yeah. We've lost the power of choice in drink. We have no effective mental defense against the first drink. We can't recall with sufficient force the pain and suffering of a week or a month ago. Ding, 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 ding. So she threw the book at me right away. Oh, and then she said, yes, I'll be your sponsor. Are you an alcoholic? Yes. Willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol? Yes. Okay, here's what I want you to do. I'm like, whoa, oh, yeah. Let me catch my breath. Yeah. She said, we got to arrange a calling time for you. You got to call me every day. Call my pager, and I'll call you back. Okay, I said, well, what time? And she says, think about it, because that's going to be the last choice you make all by yourself for a long time. So I picked 5:30, and she started me on a path. She gave me a prayer habit, a meeting habit, a reading habit, prayer habit. I was raised Catholic. We prayed on our knees. Hadn't been doing it for a while, felt kind of awkward, you know. She goes, I want you to pray on your knees morning and night. I'm like, oh, it's kind of awkward. I feel like, God knows I'm kind of faking it. But it was awkward, taking my shirt off at bars, too. So, why not pray on my knees? Right? And she goes, I don't really care what you say. Help me, whatever. Thank you, whatever. And at the end of the day, thank you. That's it. And over time, you'll figure it out. You'll develop a habit. But I want you to get the habit of that physical action. And I have to tell you to this day, that is the single most effective thing I've ever done to maintain my relationship with my God and Father. I can't very well tell him what to do from my knees or sometimes on my face. So I did the, step two, can you believe a power greater than me can restore me to sanity? That was clear. I had already got a manager, my power, step one, manager, sponsor. Step two, insane. I knew I was insane. I didn't know if the power would really be able to relieve me. That seemed like a very personal mission for God, who's everywhere and everything. And I was also detached, but I love what it says in the second step where it says, deep down inside every man, woman, child is a fundamental idea of God, and it is only there that he may be found. In the last analysis, it's only there that he may be found. I never looked for God within. And it says he's blocked. The existence of God is blocked by obstinacy, calamity, pomp, worship of other things. Worshiping my job so I don't lose it. Worship, what am I giving my time to? Right? Calamities. That's everything from, I can't believe they looked at me sideways, to the flat tire on 285, to the sudden death of the man I fell in love with in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alright? It's just anything bad that shouldn't happen to me. Now, if it happens to you, I'll coach you through it. Trust God. It'll work out. You'll see the experience will benefit others. And when me, I'm like, So, but I believed it. It made sense to me that I couldn't feel the light from within. I only lived in the darkness because it was all covered up by all these things that blocked the channel. And she said, seeking God is a within job. I was always looking out there to play, to blame my crappy life on. And no one poured that vodka down my throat. I remember some of the efforts to control and enjoy. They give those experiments. One of mine was the tequila and O'Doul's experiment. Now, you're insane if you're doing the tequila and O'Doul's experiment. Even the bartender's like, how does that work? So anyway, my sponsor told me, I want you to come to this meeting at this time. Come early, clean the ashtrays, sit in the front, bring your book. And this was before big books were involved. This is 25 years back. Not a lot of big book action. Scattered. So I'm going to 8111. A lot of big book there. I'm coming in with my book and following the sponsor. And she's got all the pigeons in the back. And I'm like, what's a pigeon? Oh, they just go around and crap on everybody. And I'm like, that's nice. But that was old school, right? But then somebody from Boston told me, but they also carry a message. I'm like, okay, I'm back. And so we sit in the front and we'd have to read along in our books and people say, is this a big book meeting? No. Why do you have your big book? Bring it. AA meeting, then you're AA, Why you sit in the front row? We're sitting back there. So this is Brian needs to hit. We take actions we don't believe and get the results that cannot be denied. So she was just setting me up for a life of discipline that was outlined in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this was her way of measuring my willingness. Because the book says, if you want, we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. So the morning came, she calls me up the night before and says, hey, you need to be at my house at 9 o'clock, bring your big book and whatever you need to eat. I know you're diabetic, I don't need you passing out. I'm like, okay. But this was before GPS and stuff, and I had to Google map it, and I didn't know how long does it take to get there, and I was in the weeds, man. I only had to do three things a day, call her, read the book, get to a meeting, and I was like, I can't. Yeah. I was running eight restaurants. I can't. Yeah. I could. But after about 2 weeks, I didn't like it. I'm like, I want to go to the cool meeting with my friends. I don't want to go to the treatment center meeting with your sponsors who hate me. They hated me because I was compliant, because it was scary not doing what she said. She never like yelled or anything, but you could tell if you didn't follow, you could just get another sponsor. And I was already so busy hating her, I wasn't thinking about drinking. That was a nasty trick. But I was feeling better. And I couldn't explain how. So anyway, so I go to her house and she goes, you know why you're here? I said, we're going to work some steps. And she goes, I'm going to take you to the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, all of them? She said, half measures ago, that's nothing. I'm like, geez, you know. But she explained, we've already done 1, 2, and 3. We're going to do a prayer here, we're going to do a prayer there, and we're going to launch. Because I'd already proven the first three are decisions. So 4, we don't do the columns. She gave me these cards developed by Clarence Snyder. And they're very provocative questions. And they don't leave really anything out. Like the very first one is, list all the most shameful, disgusting things you've ever done. And don't leave out incest, sex with animals, and bestiality, some other stuff. Now, if you can do that one, that secret's coming out. Right? And all through those questions, how about that secret? Forget that secret? Get that secret down. Right? So, all those steps. So meanwhile, she's taking a nap, and I'm crying out on her porch because I've never done this. And it's, you know, even the Christian principle of this kind of recovery is, you know, purgation, self-illumination, and then union. So I'm purging, you know, and approaching self-illumination. It's not good, you know. My will and my life on paper. But when I was done, she said, I didn't lift the steps. She gave me her fifth step, and I didn't feel so bad after all. And then step 6 was a landing place. Because she says, here's the result of your will and your life. How do you like that? I'm like, not so much, really. I don't want to do that anymore. And I remember with my, you know, repetitive indiscretions, I say, can I just put IBID on those? Because they're, just see the last one. Because there's a lot I don't remember. I mean, thank God for blackouts. I'd still be doing my 4 steps. So we get that out, and 6 is where I landed. Yes, I'm ready. Please remove. And the book says, the key to 6 is object to it. If you don't object, it's not going anywhere. My mother was the kindest person I know, and she was also known to be the most witty. She became alcoholic after my father left. She was years alcoholic. She finally got recovery, and I was able to honor her through her slow decline with COPD and be there at her bedside. And my brothers lived far and wide and weren't as close to her. I was able to go and visit her and spend weekends with her. She'd mark it on the calendar. You visited me 9 times this month. Like it was some kind of a treat. Having some sarcastic, snotty kid make fun of the classical music she played. And then when I played it in her dying days, all I can do now is cry when I hear it. I'm going to go see Andrea Bocelli in February by myself and cry my eyes out and think about my mama. And I remember, and I'm talking about step 6 because I remember people saying at her service, everybody was saying she was so witty and so kind. And I remember that her wit never had a hint of sarcasm. And it dawned on me at 10 years sober, sarcasm isn't funny. I think it's funny when I'm doing it. So it doesn't dawn on me until I'm ready to object. And sometimes it has to, you know. But when I object and then ask God to remove, then I practice the antidote to whatever it is. If I'm lying, I practice honesty. Hopefully God mitigates the lying, right? If I'm resentful, I forgive. How do I do that? Well, I learned this about forgiveness. Take an action of kindness. I remember I had a relationship in Alcoholics Anonymous, pretty predominant couple at a time, and then he found someone that was much more suitable, and I'll show them. I'm not making them zucchini bread. It's a holiday party. They're not getting any. Everybody else is going to get zucchini bread, but not them. I'll show them. I thought, you're kidding yourself? Make them the damn bread and put both their names on it. And I did, and it healed all my resentment, and God had a better plan anyway, because that guy introduced me to the love of my life, who had no sober time whatsoever. And he was struggling and struggling and struggling to get sober, but he showed me how to pray, and he showed me how to stay at it and trust. At a time when I was 10 years sober and I was so desperate to hang on to my job in the economic downturn, and I was leading meetings, I was sponsoring people, and I wasn't giving any time to steps 10 and 11. So I learned, actually take acts of kindness toward the person you resent, and it's amazing how the resentment dissipates. But I've got to take an action. This is a practical program of action. I learned another way. We had a rule. Do your laundry, washer, dryer, and out. Washer, dryer, and out. And one time, it was not out. And we were kind of having a little thing. Anyway, so I'm taking it out, and I'm folding it. And as I'm folding it, and those shirts, and the love all came back. So I do that today. So anyway, what's that? Where was it? Step 10? Yeah, continue to take personal inventory. Well, 9. Okay, so I do the fifth step, and my sponsor had the list for my eighth step. I'm like, what? How does that work? I'm like, I got a break or something, you know? She goes, oh, no, I made your eighth step list, I guess. And it's interesting, the harms and the resentment, same people. Yeah. Same people. I don't get along with people, right? So, and I have to fix that, not them. People are messy business. So she said, do the easiest one first, do one a week, you know, and keep moving. And remember, you said you're willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. Yeah, I got you. And from that day on, she said, go to every meeting and share. Up to this time, no sharing. You got no experience. Do not talk. And I hear that sometimes, you know, when people come in and they might come out of treatment, or they might just come in off the street and they're sharing because they think it's like group therapy. And all you hear is the crazy. But it's good because that reminds me what my mind is like. You know, yes, the old timers on the path ahead, but man, I need you new people to work with. Because you remind me of where I came from and where I can go back to easily without a practical program of action. For me, it's not about just going to meetings. If I just go to meetings, I'm leaving the meetings. Okay? So for me, it's more than that. It's that active one-on-one. At the core of this, it remains simple and personal. Each day somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic shares with another alcoholic their experience, strength, and hope. And my sponsor said, not piss, moan, and complain. Which I do like to do. So anyway, so step 10. She said, make it a written nightly review. It's step 11. I'm not going to engage in the debate about 10 and 11. Not going there. But for me, the written inventory at night with the questions from the nightly review helped me see how I was doing on the spot check during the day. Hey, when you were with the fear today, did you stop and pause and ask God? Or did you just barrel through like you usually did and just respond? Right? So it gives me a chance to study, how am I doing? Because I want to change. And people who don't trust me around them want to see me change. And that's what sobriety is. A changed behavior, so much so that people think there is a new path, right? And they're not apt to be triggered when they hear I'm coming. Yeah? Nightmare rides again. So that was step 10. Where I did it diligently for years, and now it's pretty, you know, it is pretty, you know, habitual. And I can do it mentally, but I never did inventory in my head before. So why would I do a moral, you know, step 10? It says inventory. It's written. And then step 11, you know, it started less that awkward getting on my knees. And in the early days, I did the third step prayer. And then in the excuse me, when I started sharing in meetings, I switched to the Prayer of St. Francis, Make Me a Channel of Thy Peace. And I kind of stick with that, and it's in the front of my book, and it reminds me that I get by giving, and I get by self-forgetting. And I have to practice what that looks like, the giving, the self-forgetting. It's not just enough to know I'm supposed to self-forget. I don't go out and do something. You know, I've been struggling. I'm not like super sober. I'm practicing the program, but you know, in a frantic effort to appear recovered, I want to let you know, I got to practice this thing. I got a thing going on with a coworker, and she is not God, and I don't know why she gets to be God in my head, right? So I got to practice this so I can get it right size. And remember my value in the eyes of my Creator, because He gave me a reason to live. He gave me people I could help. I get to see lights go on in people's eyes. My sponsor told me my eyes were dark like a shark's when I got here. They're not. And today, you know, so 11. And that's changed, you know, 11 is sometimes, you know, I've also, you know, it says in the reading, it's crazy. Because I got to a point where I was doing other readings. You know, hey, you know. Oh, sorry, 688, I gotta take this little devotional here and that one over there. But it's kind of been here, and I was reminded a little over a month ago, we attend to those also, not in place of. So, and back to the basics again, you know, put the other, just get back and get a good prayer habit again and really look at what does self-will look like in your life. You know, that's obstinate, you know, standing in what I want to do, and it's not the same as, you know, self-centeredness. So all those words are different. I love looking up words. You know, malady. You know, that is a deep-seated and chronic condition of the body. That's not gonna be overcome with a few meetings and Attagirl. Right? And I do this work with others because I treat what's between my two ears. I love it because they say my alcoholism is out there in the parking lot doing push-ups. And I'm like, I wish it was that far away. Maybe I could outrun it. and the 12, you know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. The spiritual awakening continues, but there was definitely something that happened after I did step 5 with my sponsor. There was an unburdening that I'd never felt, and there was a feeling of belonging. It's like I had the secret handshake to AA. I go to a meeting and I'm like, yeah, you did my step 4, done it, you know. 5, feeling it, you know. Share, no! And then my sponsor shares first, I'm like, why do you do that? I can't follow that. So she used to elbow me halfway through. If I'm not sharing, she makes me put my hand in the air. She says, just ask God to give you the words. And sometimes, and she says, share at every meeting. And every now and then, she's not there, and I'm thinking, I'm not sharing today. And then someone says something that makes me just erupt from the, you know. I don't erupt, like, physically, but I'm not keeping my mouth shut on that one, right? So I ask God to let me carry the message to the still-suffering alcoholic, and I can do that within AA and outside of AA when it's appropriate. I've got nieces and nephews that I try to, you know, when they have problems, I try to use that, some of that spiritual speak and the actions we can take and don't have to act on our feelings. And if you don't do it just because you're afraid, you may regret it, you know, those kind of things. And my family life is very different. I never got married. I was always too unlovely in my cups. I was proposed to once on a dance floor. We were really hammered. It was at the Women's College. It was a townie. And he's like, marry me! And I'm like, no! That was the proposal. But, you know, what my dating life didn't look like my friend Donna's. You know, her father was a trooper, and the guys would have to go up to a front state trooper. And they'd have to go to the front door and get through Trooper Kelly to have a date with Donna. Me? He calls and says, look, I'm going to drive past the house, double clutch in the hollow, turn around at the cemetery, come back, and you better be out on the lawn. Dating. No, Meredith style. So, and I wanted to be different, you know, amends, not just the way I'm going to change my life, like the dentist who always sees me first because I'm not going to go drunk to that oral surgeon again, I can tell you that. He said, how much did you drink last night? You know, so I take certain amends where they don't even know how lucky they are that I'm here early and not drunk, you know. And then some of them are the amends that I want to make. You know, how, what kind of woman do I want to be? How do I want to show up? I decided if I ever wanted to be secure in a relationship with a man, I would certainly have to stop making the first move. Because if I, and if I persist, I mean, let's face it, we can all stalk when we really want to get down to it. And you never know if they're just surrendering because they're tired of running. Or if they like you. You know? So this guy, that this other girl was texting all the time, she said, invite him for dinner and you can invite somebody. And so I sent that guy the text. And this was, I was in a 10-year sober. And I said, how about dinner the four of us Christmas Eve? He said, sounds great, except leave the other two out. I'm like, oh, he likes me. Oh. Oh. And I always thought he had beautiful eyes and he had a really gentle spirit. And I thought, the other girl, she's not going to like this. Because I'm going to ask her if it's okay if I ask you out. And that ended that friendship for about 7 years. We're back to being friends now. But and so I started this journey with a man with not a lot of sobriety, but really pursued it and got it. And he lost his job and his house and his marriage, and the wife and the child moved to Phoenix, and he was only 4 when they moved. And Jeff rented a room in my house, and then we became closer, and then the relationship evolved. And it's the first relationship I've ever been in where giving was the guiding principle. It wasn't what can I get out of this, what can I bring to this relationship. And it was extraordinary, and it was like kind of grown up. And difficult because he was not very happy at the time. He was losing a lot, you know, and wasn't sure how his life was going to end up. And he even had some ideas of maybe reconciling with his wife, although the more sober he got, the more different he realized they were. But we both lost our jobs around the same time, and I just sponsored women like it was my job and just trusted God and ended up getting a job out of state, and he got hired in Phoenix for a job, much below his ability, but it would reunite him with his son. And he wanted to be with his son because he wanted to be able to share what he had and be a father. And so it started a journey of me working out of town, him working out of town, and just trusting God that it was going to work out the way it was supposed to. And I got to see him a couple of times because I was opening restaurants in his area, and that was good. And I never really met his son. I'd hear him on phone calls and whatnot. I never did get married, of course, and I never had children. I always thought maybe I'll adopt a couple of angry boys one day, who knows. And what happened was he became sick and had surgery, and the night he was supposed to be discharged, he died. He stood up and died from an embolism at the age of 50. And, you know, it was 2 weeks after my mother had died to the day. It was the summer of 2011, and I thank God for the foundation of faith that I had, because I don't know how I would have really... I wasn't shaking my fist at the sky, angry at God, because I know now that I don't know his ways, and the mystery is part of it. I have to leave the mystery to God and just do the footwork. And I was invited by his family to speak at his funeral, and bringing God's comfort was what they said after my name. I'm like, who do they think I am, you know? Family said, are you ecumenical? I'm like, I don't even know what that means, but I don't think I am. But I met his son named Gunnar, and we began a friendship. And his grandmother, you know, he would come from Phoenix and spend time with Daddy at Christmas and Thanksgiving, and Daddy take a snowmobiling and, you know, skeets or whatever, you know. And his mom's a real girly girl. And I'd met Jeff's mom a few times, and she said, Gunner's coming for Christmas. He's only 8. What am I going to do? I said, come out and play with him. We played Beyblades until I was losing my mind. It was so much fun. And I decided to take him skiing because he was living near his very wealthy cousins. And they go to Breckenridge and all that. And I thought, if he doesn't learn how to ski or snowboard, he's going to be left out. And so I'm a skier, and I let him choose. He goes, I want a snowboard. I said, I'm fine. So I put on a snowboard. But we're walking around the ski, you know, lodge, and I'm holding his hand. He's 8, and I'm walking around, and I'm helping tie his boots and stuff. And someone said, you got a cute little boy there. I'm like, thank you. And he said, do they think you're my mom? I said, yes, they do. And he said, why? I said, because I'm adorable, and I'm holding your hand. It started a yearly event, but we decided to do it in March instead of Christmas time, spring skiing, when the weather's nice, And I can, you know, not worry about being cold and stuff. And now he shreds it. He's so good at singing. I mean, he loved it. And there was years where I couldn't even sit in the same chair. He'd have to be the one ahead of me, teenager. Took him hiking up through the Blue Ridge Mountains, but we made sure we stayed in the Hampton Inn for Wi-Fi showers. You know, we're not the same. I took him on a self-guided, a very special fishing trip in the waters of Jacksonville with a guy who'd lived there all his life and knew all spots. He'd never been fishing. And so I was able to bring this boy the life that maybe his father would have done if he'd lived. Plus, I did it at first to hang on to the memory of his dad. But what happened was I got this beautiful gift of relationship with a boy who knows about nightmare. He knows about my sponsees. Sometimes he'll say, tell me about the craziest one you have right now. He would go to AA meetings with me. I remember I did a step three meeting in more about alcoholism. And at the end he said, I think I might be an alcoholic. 15 years old. Right? He had trouble with smoking pot and drinking. And he invited himself and decided to enlist in the Army to serve. He said, look, I know it's going to suck, he said, but it's really going to set me up for my future. I'm like, what kind of teenager thinks like that, who didn't have a dad, you know? He asked me to be his godmother. And I greet him at the plane, you know, when he comes to visit, and people say, is that your grandma? No, she's my friend. This is Go Army, and I'm going to wear it until he comes home from Iraq. You know, he goes in, hey, it's pretty quiet in the Middle East, that's great. Then he gets sent there, and it's all blowing up. And he's in a special force that guides leadership off the base. They're like the protective service. He gets to carry a pistol and wear civvies, and he's pretty happy about that. But he's in danger. I trust God and do the footwork. I'm sorry for you who know my story that I left out how I hit my bottom. I did it because I was in love with a gay man and I didn't know it. For those of you who heard my story, bust that out. But see, God has a sense of humor, right? He brings me in to save a relationship that doesn't even exist. So I trust God, right? So I can trust God. Whatever he's got is going to be better than from what I've got. And in the meanwhile, I'll chop wood, carry water, try to serve, be there for the newcomer. Because when I stay in the steps, I stay safe up here. And I learned, too, early on that service isn't just sponsorship. My first sponsor was really just about sponsorship. My second sponsor, Rusty, got me a little bit more, you know, but I started, you know, serving. I really liked the intergroup. That's how I got to know Avery. That's where I met Rebecca at a presentation at the GSSA or something like that. And I want to be counted among the ones that serve, that complete the triangle. And the triangle to me means I start at the bottom left and I pursue. What I want is over here on the right. This is how I see my life. But if I go after what I want on the right, I don't get an opportunity to let God provide what I needed as long as I stayed close to him and performed his work well. So I seek God, and he delivers in a ways that I cannot possibly imagine. And one of those ways is being invited to speak here to you today. And I didn't even cry. My brother Matthew, who gave me this diamond, the only diamond I was ever given by a man was my brother Matt. And he was the closest to me. I had two brothers die during COVID. One died of despair. So I know you can do that. I know that comes in my family. Just will yourself. Stop eating and just go. And he also was a fervent believer in God. And he would send me all the time, praying for you, praying for you, praying for you. But as I held his hand and felt his pulse stop, he wasn't sure God was there. Because of all the stuff he left in his soul. He was trying to be connected with God by words, scripture, you know, but never the purgation. Never the freedom. And my brother Matthew didn't have to take a 12-step program to be the most generous soul I knew. And I made posters for his concerts when he was young. He became a champion of any artist. He gave away guitars like they were going out of style. And he fought for my honor when I didn't have any. And he married a woman who was as alien from him as possible. It was just a bad match. And he had three alien children. And one of the things I do today is, again, the things I have to demonstrate love even when I don't understand them. And they don't live like I live. And they don't do what I want with his ashes. But he knows I will be there for his children, just like he always thanked me for doing. So today I hope that I bring honor to my family, my friends, the people I sponsor, the shoulders I stand on, and Alcoholics Anonymous for giving me the life I have today. Thank you very much.
I have a problem with drinking.
I can tell. Thank you so much. That was such an incredible story. I so appreciate that. And on behalf of the committee, we have a little gift for you.
Thank you so much.
And we thank you again for coming.
Thank you.
Okay.